Powers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Hassan. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, Ontario Six Nations community will host Canada's largest electricity battery storage project.
We need to take control of our destiny, and this is one example of how we can do that. We're going to put our people to work. Combine those things together, you have a great socioeconomic impact for a community that really needs it. And I think it speaks as an example that we're doing our part to create value.
The French immersion program phase-out still very unpopular in New Brunswick. Citizens are still waiting to know if New Brunswick's premier, Blaine Higgs, will stay the course or back down.
I think it's important for people who believe that the education system should be improved in different ways.
To Nova Scotia, where the minimum wage will increase to $15 an hour in October. But more needs to be done, says the Halifax Workers Action Centre.
We see that a $15 minimum wage is almost $9 less than what it basically costs to make ends meet in Halifax. It's becoming clearer and clearer every day that higher wages are needed.
The University of Fraser Valley's Peace and Reconciliation Center will soon offer a non-credit program focused on reconciliation building for non-Indigenous Canadians.
It's built in response to some requests from actually a variety of different places. One is from settlers, you know, non-Indigenous people who are saying, how do I become an ally? How do I become someone who can assist in a knowing way and in an appropriate way, Indigenous people?
This and more on Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
We start the show in Ontario, where the Ford government just made a big announcement. Six nations of the Grand River Territory will be home to Canada's largest electricity battery storage project. Its construction should be completed by 2025. The 250-megawatt Oneida Energy Storage Project will enter into a 20-year contract with the Independent Electricity System Operator. Six Nations of the Grand River Development Corporation CEO Matt Jameson said the community will benefit from this project as an investor and hopes the economic returns it generates will help bridge the infrastructure gap on Six Nations. More with Andrew Dow in Oshawa, Ontario.
The governments of Ontario and Canada announced a partnership with the Six Nations of the Grand River Development Corporation, Northland Power, Enerstor, and Aecon Group to bring the largest electricity battery storage project in Canada to Six Nations of the Grand River. The 250-megawatt Oneida Energy Storage Project will enter into a 20-year contract with the Independent Electricity System Operator to support the growth of the province's clean energy supply. The Oneida Energy Storage Project is expected to reduce emissions by between 2.2 to 4.1 million tons, the equivalent of taking up to 40,000 cars off the road. Premier Doug Ford announced the project and detailed the benefits it will have on the energy storage supply.
I'm so thrilled to be here today with our First Nations, businesses, and federal government partners to celebrate the largest electricity storage project in Canada, as you heard, and one of the largest in the entire world. Once online in 2025, this project, the Oneida Energy Storage Project, will store up to 250 megawatts of electricity in lithium batteries during off-peak hours when demand is low, and release it to our electricity grid when it's needed. It will more than double our province's energy storage resources and will provide enough electricity to power a city approximately the size of Oshawa. And I'm pleased to announce that our government has directed Ontario's electricity system operator to enter into a 20-year contract with Oneida Energy Storage Project so that this new facility will support our clean electricity system for years to come.
Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland talked about the significance of this announcement and what it means for Indigenous communities taking control of their own economic future.
You know, today, this announcement, this project, this really is the best of Canada. This is about Canada today, and this is about Canada's future. This is about Indigenous prosperity, Indigenous people taking control of their lives and their economy. It's about Canada's clean economy future and our clean economy present and the jobs that we are creating today and for the future, because that's where the world is going, and Canada is going to get its share of those jobs. This is about collaboration between the private sector, three great companies here, and the public sector. And it's about collaboration between the federal government and a great provincial government that is a very important partner for us.
Six Nations Chief Mark Hill spoke on his hopes to collaborate on this project and future ones to create jobs and allow Six Nations to incorporate their training and services into these projects.
It's all about collaboration, in my view, and it's all about creation of jobs. And that's something that we want to build upon for our community and look at ways that we can incorporate our current services and training opportunities so that we can, again, build upon not just Ontario and Canada, but as well as Six Nations of the Grand River.
Six Nations of the Grand River Development Corporation CEO Matt Jamieson spoke on Six Nations being an investor in the project and how the investment returns on this project will help to bridge the infrastructure gap that Six Nations is currently dealing with.
Not only are we an investor in the project, which means that there's going to be an economic return, those economic returns will go a long way to help plug things that are important to our community. Like right now, we are facing a $1.6 billion infrastructure gap in our community. We can't wait for funding for federal transfer payments. We need to take control of our destiny, and this is one example of how we can do that. So the investment returns are part of it. But also, as a constructor in our partnership with Aecon through A6N Joint Venture, we're going to put our people to work. The A6N Joint Venture has put $50 million in payroll in our community since we started that joint venture, and it has a 97% Indigenous workforce. And so we're very proud that not only are we developing this partnership, we're investing in it, but we're actually going to be constructing it. And building that kind of capacity leads to a really great future for our people who go through those skills, training, and learning so that we can continue to do these things and leverage that skill set over and over again. You combine those things together, you have a great socioeconomic impact for a community that really needs it. And I think it speaks as an example that we're doing our part to create value, not just for our community, but there's also value for the ratepayers. And our community members are ratepayers. So if we can save the grid, the ratepayers' money, that means that we're saving our homeowners' money here as well.
Chief Hill spoke on the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Chiefs Council involvement in the project and acknowledged that the community needs to determine its internal affairs and work together as one to benefit its community members.
I think at the end of the day, what we have to do and what we know we have to do at Six Nations is we have to figure out our own internal affairs and what that looks like. I think we need to, for once and for all, get in one room and figure out how our community is going to be inclusive to the current diversity. We know we're very large and we're continuing to grow. And so those opportunities that we have, there's been every opportunity for the Confederacy to join in through the engagement process through this project. Again, it's not like it was just started last night. It's been a number of years into the making. And again, have the utmost respect for our hereditary council, our chiefs and clan mothers. And again, we'll be looking at ways on how we could further build our relationships because it's for our people at the end of the day.
Doug Ford announced that the project is slated to be completed by 2025. Scano, I'm Andrew Dow in Six Nations Ontario. You are listening to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
In New Brunswick, a group of residents from the Tantramar area in the southeast of the province are gathering signatures for a petition in support of maintaining French immersion in the province. Organizer Laurie Ann Ronis says the petition isn't just a focus on asking for the government to back down on its plan to modify its French immersion program, but also to improve education outcomes in English learning as well. That includes more teachers, more support staff, and more educational health professionals, adds Ronis. Ronis and a number of other Tantramar residents in cities such as Sackville, Port Elgin, and Dorchester opposed the government's latest plan, which would see French immersion and English prime phased out and replaced by a new 50-50 program starting in kindergarten and grade one. New Brunswick's Premier Blaine Higgs still refuses to say if he will back down from the proposed changes to French immersion in view of the massive opposition to his plan from all across the province. More with Erica Butler.
First, it asks the Department of Education to cease its pursuit of the framework. It asks the department to maintain and enhance the existing French immersion program and make it accessible to more students with the long-term goal of building meaningful bilingualism, not just reducing French to the capacity of being able to order a hamburger. The second key thing that the petition asks is that the Department of Education strategically address the current challenges that exist across all facets of the education system. So that includes improving faster access or having access to improve services, more efficient assessments, and having more qualified and experienced teachers in both languages, along with support staff, educational support staff, allied educational health professionals, and resources like psychologists and mental health.
Ronis says the petition will go to Memram Cook-Tantramar MLA Megan Mitten for presentation to the legislature in March. And because it's going to the legislature, the petition can't be online but needs handwritten signatures.
Anyone in New Brunswick can sign the petition of any age. So it's not limited. The only caveat is that it has to be a written petition. And we're asking that all petitions be returned to me. I'm just kind of coordinating the gathering of them by the 3rd of March. And certainly if anyone is interested in signing or if anyone is interested in collecting signatures, they're free to contact me. We have a Facebook page, French Immersion in Sackville. And I know that there are signatures being collected every Saturday at the Sackville Farmers Market at Alice Cotton's table, and there are other people circulating as well.
Ronis and a number of other residents from the Facebook group called French Immersion Supporters in Sackville NB attended a public consultation session hosted by the Department of Education last month. Teachers, parents, and administrators came out in droves to express their concerns about the government's proposed plan, which would see French immersion and English prime phased out and a new 50-50 program introduced starting in kindergarten in grade one. The New Brunswick Teachers Association was the latest group to ask the government to shelve the plan, calling for an end to political interference in education. Amidst the public opposition, Premier Blaine Higgs told reporters last week that the plan is not a sure thing. Ronis says that possible capitulation is not enough to stop the need to organize a petition among Sackville area residents.
Well, I'm not sure if the government is really releasing official statements. We've definitely heard some rumblings, and I know that there are other MLAs that are starting to voice their concern with the petitions from across all party lines, I guess. I think until the government comes out with an explicit statement and commitment, I think it's important for people who believe that the education system should be improved in different ways to maintain that voice. Petitions are one way that, you know, the regular person can put their voice to an issue. And it's relatively safe for people who don't necessarily feel comfortable in front of the limelight. But the more signatures on a petition that's presented to the legislature, the louder that voice is perceived by the government. So I think it's important to stay the course with the petition and make the sentiment known and make the request to the government known.
That's Sackville resident Lorianne Ronis. To get in touch with Ronis or other petition organizers, check out the Facebook group French Immersion Supporters in Sackville NB.
That was Erica Butler.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
The Nova Scotia government is soon going to increase the minimum wage in the province. The increase is set for October 1st, 2023, and will reach $15 an hour 6 months ahead of schedule. The province has also agreed to adjust the minimum wage annually based on the projected consumer price index percentage, plus an additional 1% starting April 1st, 2024. The latest numbers published on January 1st by the Retail Council of Canada show that the highest minimum wage in Canada is in Nunavut at $16 an hour. It's set at more than $15 an hour in Yukon, the Northwest Territories, British Columbia, Alberta, and Ontario, the lowest being in Saskatchewan at $13 an hour. The minimum wage increase is welcome in Nova Scotia, but more needs to be done, says Lisa Cameron, executive director of the Halifax Workers Action Center. The organization is calling on the Nova Scotia government to enact a $20 minimum wage and ensure that all future increases account for inflation plus 1%. Reporter Sarah Gouda spoke with Lisa Cameron.
Lisa, can you tell us why, what you want the minimum wage to increase to? What do you think it should be for Nova Scotians?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, we have to recognize the achievement of a $15 minimum wage. I started in the labor movement with a group called Fight for 15 and Fairness back in 2017. And as a low-wage worker at the time, I do remember feeling like a $15 minimum wage was a bit of a dream, but an important one. So I think for many workers and many members of the labor movement, this is a significant moment. But that being said, the cost of living has also been rising exponentially. $15 today isn't what it was back in 2017, for example. So when we look at the cost of living in Halifax, that's calculated at $23.50 per hour by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, we see that a $15 minimum wage is almost $9 less than what it basically costs to make ends meet in Halifax. So the Halifax Workers Action Centre, alongside Justice for Workers, is calling on the Nova Scotia government to enact a $20 minimum wage, as well as ensure that all future increases to the provincial minimum wage account for inflation plus 1%. And that's because we need to see all workers at least earning a living wage.
Can you tell us a little bit about your organization?
The Halifax Workers Action Center was established in 2017. It was a joint project of Solidarity Tubuktuk Halifax, which is no longer in existence, and the Halifax, Dartmouth, and District Labor Council. We offer free legal information and support to low-wage, marginalized, and non-unionized workers in Nova Scotia who are facing some sort of employment issue. Workers call with all different kinds of questions or concerns about their workplace problem. Over 60% of our callers have been terminated or have had to leave their jobs within 2 weeks of first calling us. So when you consider the fact that many of our workers, nearly 40%, are earning less than $30,000 a year, which is nowhere near what it costs to afford your basic necessities, and are now experiencing a loss of income, a complete loss of income, we're dealing with a group, a population that is quite vulnerable and really facing those the impacts of poverty. So our goal is to educate workers about their rights and to ultimately organize for positive change and push for policy improvements.
How many times have you been hearing this be an issue? I guess, do many people feel the same way about the $15 being minimum wage? Do many people feel that, no, it should be a $20 minimum wage?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of, in part, false information about minimum wage increases and what that ultimately means for the economy. So sometimes, you know, workers are quite nervous in a sense when the minimum wage goes up because they've been told that as soon as their wages increase, you know, they're going to find themselves unemployed. But I think that when you look at the fact that there is no real permanent and substantial, for example, rent control legislation in the province and food costs are rising, I don't think it's very, like, I think it's, you know, a pretty normal experience to feel pretty strained financially right now. So I do think that a $15 minimum wage isn't as controversial as it felt back when I started in 2017, when it felt like $15 was a really high number. But I think that it's becoming clearer and clearer every day that higher wages are needed.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
We now turn to British Columbia, where the University of the Fraser Valley's Peace and Reconciliation Center, or PARC, is launching a new initiative focusing on allyship and reconciliation building. Beginning this month, Park, in partnership with the Stalo Nation and various Stalo agencies, is offering a non-credit program that aims to help non-Indigenous Canadians foster authentic allyship with the Stalo people in the Fraser Valley. Park is an initiative put together by various community leaders who wanted to answer the question of how to help those in crisis and how we build peace with the Stalo people. Director of UFV's Peace and Reconciliation Center, Dr. Keith Carlson, talks with reporter Stephen Munga about the work Park is doing in the community and what the new initiative entails.
The Peace and Reconciliation Center is a unique kind of center in Canada. It had its foundings in conversations that faculty members like Stephen Schroeder, community members like Fran Vanderpool and Archway in Abbotsford and others had to talk about how do we do peace building? How do we help people with the trauma? How do we help people who are in crises? And from those early discussions, they worked towards creating a center that was then expanded. And this is all before my time arriving here. They expanded that to then also include mandates to connect with and help to build reconciliation, say, between communities and across communities, so Indigenous settler divides and that sort of thing. And I became involved in 2020. I was started as a faculty member here in 2019 when I returned to the Fraser Valley. And in 2020, they asked me to chair the committee. And then the following year, in January of 2021, they asked me to step in and become the director of the center. The Allyship and Reconciliation Building Program is our newest initiative under the Peace and Reconciliation Center. It's built in response to some requests from actually a variety of different places. One is from settlers, you know, non-Indigenous people who are saying, how do I become an ally? How do I become someone who can assist in a knowing way and an appropriate way Indigenous people as they fight for cultural resurgence and for political self-governance and some meaningful reconnection with and stewardship and management over their traditional lands and resources? And then on the other side, Indigenous leaders, members of the Stalo community were asking, you know, can the Peace and Reconciliation Center step in to take some of the weight off their shoulders in terms of time commitments and things that relate to educating non-Indigenous settlers, because they were getting a lot of requests and they feel this is a priority, but that they need to focus their energies on working with and building capacity within their own communities. So that was a way that we could say, yeah, we can partner with you in that way, and we can help work with you to design and implement a program that meets those needs with those broader goals.
And the program itself, it entails like what? Are there going to be workshops and things of that nature?
A mixture of monthly presentations and workshops. So knowledgeability in terms of, you know, who are the Stalo people? What is their culture and history? What are their aspirations today? And how are they trying to kind of rebuild their own nation as they connect with, in a more respectful way, the larger Canadian nation? The other side is, what is the history of settler colonialism, and how has racism and white privilege and various things given a certain shape to that settler colonialism in this part of the world? And then hands-on workshops where you're learning from the land and learning from Indigenous people about how to connect with and appreciate the environment, the nature, the landscape and the waterscapes of the Fraser Valley.
Is there anything else?
We want people to come to us, faculty and students and community organizations, community members, saying, I see an opportunity for peace building in this forum or in this situation or in this relationship. And I'd really like to work with like-minded people to form or join a community of practice around various thematic ideas that we can advance then and make genuine differences in people's lives. We have a team of faculty commitment leaders who oversee various communities of practice: Gitanjali Jill, Stephen Schroeder, Lola Hawk, Laura Bucher, and Amanda McCormick, and then myself as the director. And beyond that, we have emerging initiatives, some of them that are directed by students. There's some funding opportunities that we provide on our website for faculty and students to build new initiatives, bring speakers in, engage voices, have difficult conversations and facilitate those, and hopefully build new programmatic initiatives. So now that we're crawling out the other end of the COVID crisis, we're really hoping to go from, you know, a walk to a jog in terms of our pacing and accomplishments.
The program consists of 11 sessions beginning on February 28th and will run a monthly until December 19th. My name is Stephen Munga. For these and more stories from local journalists across Canada, visit canada-info.ca.
stay in BC, where the city of Prince Rupert is currently in the process of rebranding and upgrading signs around town. It's an original project, one that will feature the Smalayach language. The new logo design for the city is being completed by Tsimshian artist Russell Mather and features Smalayach language. Signs have been installed at all highway entrances to the city, as well as wayfinding signage at popular spots around town. Kaylee Marlowe, Executive Director for Tourism Prince Rupert, who led the signage project, says they plan to install more wayfinding signage within the next couple of weeks. She's with journalist Morgan Budden.
We have actually been working on this signage project since late in 2020 when the Provincial CEREP program was announced, which was the first grant funding we received for this project. And that was awarded in the spring of 2021. So then we were able to get started on the design and calling for local artists to participate in the project. So it's been in the works for a couple of years. So this was sort of a pilot to see what we could get done in the first phase and to see how the community would respond. We still do have one set to be installed that will be installed within the next couple of weeks here. So those are the posts with the sort of fingerboard signs. Those will be installed here shortly. But yeah, in the future, we do hope to expand and add more signs and do more districts. But it was important to just see first what the response was in the community, and it's been really positive so far.
All of the signs feature the Smalayach language, which Marlowe explained the importance of.
It was very important, and it was a priority from the start for us. We knew we wanted to create a new opportunity for public art, and we wanted to make sure it was a paid opportunity as well. So this was an opportunity where we were able to offer a paid art contract to five different artists, and we reserved three of those spots for Indigenous artists. So that was really something that was a huge priority for us from the very beginning. And then we reached out to the Tsimshian Smalayach Language Authority at the very outset as well to make sure that we were able to include Smalayach language.
These new signs come at the same time as the city's rebranding project, which Manager of Communications, Engagement, and Social Development for the city, Veronica Stewart, explained more about.
So it actually started in 2019-2020. So council had provided direction to staff to go out and do a call for proposals for different branding agencies to work with to do a rebrand for the city. Part of the impetus for that was, I'm not sure if you're aware of what the city's old logo looked like, but it was a crest that we've basically used for 100 years. In terms of applying it graphically, it didn't size down very well. It was super hard to read because there was writing on it. It was quite small, and it just didn't really reflect the modern community of Prince Rupert. And it also didn't reflect the Tsimshian territory that we live on appropriately. So council wanted us to kind of go back to the drawing board and come up with something that was a bit more modern.
Funded fully by grants, the signage project cost just over $200,000 and saw them installed over the first week of February.
Thanks to Morgan Budden. That's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Erica Butler, Stephen Munga, Andrew Dow, Sarah Gouda, and Morgan Budden, National Editor Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. At Viewpoints, we produce, as you know, local news nationwide, and you can find tons of stories from all across the country at canada-info.ca. That's canada-info.ca. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Great to have you with us. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week, ciao. We'll be right back.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.